This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio, and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. Each week we talk with someone making a positive difference and applying their skills to a sustainable future. In our conversations we try to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens is that of Juliet Arnott, an artist, a founder of Rekindle and an occupational therapist. Trained at Otago Polytech.
That's right, yeah.
Thank you very much for joining me.
Pleasure, it's lovely to be here.
So let's start with questions about you. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a little place called Canvastown in Marlborough, so it's in between Nelson and Blenheim near Havelock, and we were farming and pretty self-sufficient really back then in the 70s. Yeah, so it was pretty kind of...
Did you say Canvastown?
Canvastown.
Like tents?
Which was a gold rush town, yes, so it had this wonderful history. In fact, we spent a fair bit of time in our childhood with our gold pans in the river, ever hopeful. But yeah, it was a pretty lovely existence living off the land and living pretty kind of closely with the resources around us, I suppose.
And what did you want to be when you grew up?
That's a good question. I don't know that I really had a clear sense of that. I just remember being encouraged by Mum, particularly towards being creative. But no, generally, I don't recall what I was particularly aiming at.
What did you get involved in?
Well, it was a pretty, it was a pretty rural community, so it was sort of barefoot running around. You know, I just remember being outside. I remember being on the farm, involved in all the usual farming activities and really enjoying that. I do have this sort of story that I recall, which relates to how things did develop in my life, which was that Mum and Dad had this beautiful rush basket that acted as our bread basket, and I remember quite clearly this experience, and I must have been really quite young, like maybe 5 or 6, going out down to the paddock below the house, which was full of rushes, but a different kind of rush, and attempting to weave a basket, but I was completely inept and didn't have the understanding of how to do it. But I remember this kind of the kind of magic of that basket as an object, and that's kind of lingered with me, I think, and it's definitely a part of what has since rolled out in my life, I suppose, is that journey towards understanding how those simple resources can be harnessed and valued.
So I won't make the obvious connection between baskets and occupational therapy, but what got you to occupational therapy?
Yeah, well, that was my mother was a nurse, and I think when in my teenage years, when I was starting to think about what I wanted to be, she did encourage me, or my parents encouraged me towards a health profession. I remember one day, bizarrely, we were taken as on a tour of the local in Nelson, where I was at school, taking a tour in a tour of the local, what was then a psychiatric institution called Nawhatu. And it was really the old-fashioned style of institution. When we were sort of walked through it, which I look back and think how bizarre that really was for school students. But I saw this woman working in the industrial woodwork shop, and I saw her her role and thought, what an incredible role to have, to be able to work creatively with people, to work practically in that way, I suppose. And that was all I really knew of occupational therapy in some regards. And it was only when I showed up at Otago Polytech and got into the course in 1993 that I realised that actually I'd hit the jackpot, and I actually had found something that was really aligned with what I valued and was really intrigued by, I think, by its diversity and the fact that it connects with what we do every day.
Did it deliver what you were hoping?
Yes, it did. Well, yes, it did, and it didn't. It did in the sense that I learnt a lot. I learnt a huge amount through my training and through the you know, first probably 15 years of my practice, where I was attempting to, well, where I was, I guess, learning about the health system and how it functions, and then attempting to find my place within it, in terms of being able to work well and truly therapeutically within that system. But I think I just continuously hit up against the struggles of that system, and the, whether it was the lack of funding around the time that I could spend with people, or yeah, the way that services were limited in the way that they could genuinely support people through big change and challenge in their life. So it was helpful in learning some realities, but it was also, it's also been frustrating, I suppose, to be exposed to some of the current systemic challenges. But then that's probably what sort of pushed me on to look at something beyond the sort of more conventional occupational therapy role.
Because you wanted to do more than was in those bounds, or?
Yeah, I think it's, so what kind of, one of the common sort of struggles for me, and I think definitely for other occupational therapists, is that you end up working within it, within the health system, and you work with the people who have need of your support for the time that the service allows them to be a part of that service, but then you have to sort of support that person back into their home or back into their sort of daily existence outside of the service. And often there's not enough there. I'm particularly thinking in terms of mental health services. There's simply not enough there to aid that person to bridge that gap between being really quite unwell and being quite dependent on a service through to living a really sort of healthy, productive existence, engaged in community. And that gap really was something that's really difficult to do anything about from inside the service. So I guess what has happened gradually over the last few years has been that I've been attempting to create some of these opportunities that I would like for people going through those challenges to have the opportunity to experience. So it's, I guess, part of the journey recently has been about trying to kind of evolve what I was frustrated with the lack of in the past.
So what was your first venture outside the conventional bounds?
Well, in part it was probably for quite some years I worked conventionally as an occupational therapist, but on the side I would continue my own creative practice, and the two sort of coexisted, and I would kind of go to work and talk about doing my basket weaving, and my colleagues would laugh at me, and I would sort of try and explain to them how important it actually was, and I had these two very separate parts of my life, and the creative practice was very much, it was when I was living in the UK, and it was very much about my own personal connection with the environment that I was living in, but it was also about revealing the value of materials that were being wasted in the community around me. So that became a bigger and bigger part of my life outside of occupational therapy, to the point where I was being commissioned to make work sculpturally with these waste materials, and you know, would do that sort of half the time, and then in the winter when I wasn't doing that, I would work as an occupational therapist. So yeah, so it's been a kind of a gradual journey to the point where returning to New Zealand, that was when I started Rekindle, and the two sort of really came together more definitely.
What prompted the interest in waste materials?
Well, I think the reality was, sort of growing up in that sort of fairly idyllic farming situation, you sort of exposed to a fairly simple relationship to the resources around you and to understanding where the natural limits lie and how to live well with what you have around you. And then I was quite struck, actually, in a fairly naive way, when I did move to the UK in my mid-20s, and even in rural England, was surprised to find that there was quite a strong culture of consumption and disposal. And it was that, really, that pushed me to really look around in my sort of day-to-day existence and to really want to make something of the material resources that I was seeing around me that were going to waste. And that particularly started with things like the prunings from the hedgerows when they were trimmed, coppice material that was cut from willow or hazel trees, and then that sort of moved on through into, as I learnt crafts to utilise those materials, went through into use of a lot of the waste that washes up on the beaches in the UK, so a lot of rope and plastics. So it kind of just evolved as part of my needing to make sense, really, of what I was seeing around me, and kind of some sort of vain attempt, I suppose, to show the value of what that stuff was, because mostly it was being ignored.
And so that you came back here?
Yeah, so I came back in 2009, and after nine years away, and was sort of feeling relatively displaced and didn't really have a grand plan for my return home, and found myself in Auckland for the first time, which I enjoyed. But again, I realise now, I was quite naively struck by the degree of waste that I found there, and I think that I'd imagine that in New Zealand we were well beyond things like landfills, but I obviously found we weren't, and I was just surprised at the dependence on the landfill mechanism, and at that time, which is a lot has changed since, but at that time was, you know, surprised to find a big pile of wood out in one of the transfer stations in Auckland, and that was what I responded to with the initial furniture designs that I came up with for Rekindle. Mm.
So you established Rekindle.
Mm.
So Rekindle 101.
Rekindle 101, yes. So it's definitely been a big journey since then. But Rekindle 101 was, in essence, I was living in Grey Lynn in Auckland at the time. I was appreciating all the beautiful old villas around in that area and other suburbs of Auckland, and realising that there was a fairly common sight to see skips with fair amount of timbers in them, and where there were renovations happening, or to see demolitions underway, and I guess that combined with the wood pile that I'd seen in the transfer station, I was kind of very intrigued to understand what this was all about, and then to learn, of course, that construction and demolition waste are such big contributors to our landfilling here. So I decided to try and come up with a furniture design that would just reveal some of the structural integrity of that material, some of its beautiful aesthetic value, and it's obviously its cultural value in terms of it being ancient indigenous timber. And so I did that with the help of a couple of furniture makers in Auckland. We worked together to sort of prototype the first chair and then tables and stools and the like. And so I had just started putting those sort of out into the world and made a first couple of sales up in Auckland, and then started, I guess, being aware through my previous relationship with Christchurch that my old home, which I lived in my early 20s, was now facing, of course, this massive challenge with regards to demolition waste and the disempowerment that was occurring as part of that hasty process. So that was when I started to think about coming back here and what role I could play, really, in that period of demolition.
So your website makes the connection between not just the waste but the community.
Yeah.
And you just talked about that sort of in the disempowerment and the waste. Mm. So tell me, how are you bringing those two things together?
So I suppose I find it hard to look at waste without wondering how making waste affects us as humans. I think it's something that we just take for granted that we do, which, of course, naturally many of the inhabitants of this earth make waste. But I don't think we think enough about the impact of that. I think when your ability to hold on to something that you value is taken away from you, and when the resources that you have owned are taken away from you and their disposal is managed by someone else, then that in terms of how the demolition played out here was very difficult for a lot of people. I think when people are choosing to dispose of their own resources, that's a whole other story, but I think for people to have that choice taken away from them, it was very difficult, both taken away by the earthquakes themselves and the damage that occurred, and of course by the bureaucratic processes that would naturally unfold afterwards. So I think for me, as an occupational therapist, I see both the environmental concern about the waste, but it's, for me, it's much more than that. It's the kind of human experience of disposing of materials that we still see as having value. There's something futile about that. There's something, you know, even a little hopeless about not being able to take the time to value the things that we would, you know, perhaps even feel a bit guilty about throwing out ourselves if we had done it ourselves. So it's kind of, it's, yeah, it relates to that sort of our need to demonstrate value when that exists. And I think if we're not experiencing that, if we're not given the opportunity to experience it, that becomes quite problematic.
Are we not quite happy having somebody take it away?
I think we definitely are.
We put the bin right. out on the curb and it disappears.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that we would say that we probably would, in most cases, not value the material that we're putting in those bins versus, say, the residential demolition, different thing. But I think it's such a complex thing, but that there's that thing about its hidden nature being useful at times when we don't have to face the landfill. Like if the landfill was sitting just over there and we saw the seagulls and the, you know, we would, it might feel slightly uncomfortable, versus what we were seeing with the residential demolition process. That was that obvious to us. It was in our faces, and that was incredibly difficult to witness. So it's kind of, you know.
So you arrived back in Christchurch, thousands of houses being knocked down.
Mm, yeah.
Where do you start?
Yeah, it was quite overwhelming. I didn't really know what the solution was at that time. It was a very difficult bureaucratic process to even understand, let alone intercept. So I spent probably a year speaking with demolition contractors, earning their trust, getting them to understand that what I wanted to do wasn't crazy, it wasn't unsafe, that I wouldn't slow them down. And initially we did a lot of salvage just on sites where the diggers had been, and they'd just left a pile of sort of crushed timbers, and we would haul out what was still viable for furniture. But over that first year, we worked out a way that we could work in with the contractors so that we would salvage before the diggers arrived. Yeah, and that's how it got rolling, really. But that was it was only ever sort of a symbolic thing, in the sense that we were not able to grow this this capacity to salvage timber to the degree that we could really address the whole problem. But I guess we just did our best within the constraints at play. And I guess the second big response I had to the scale of it all was the Whole House Reuse Project. That very much acknowledged the fact that there were, you know, at least 9,000 homes in the red zone and more demolished beyond that. So how on earth do you attempt to kind of make a statement or celebrate the homes that were lost, or even define the value of a home? Like, it was just really hard to know how to sort of even begin to think about these issues. And so I decided that perhaps if we just put out all of our energies into the ultimately resourceful response to just one home, that we might see something from that feels heartening for us. And so that's what we did. It didn't happen for the first, you know, we worked on it for years, but it didn't really get underway until Kate McIntyre came on board as the project manager, and we managed to get a red zone home from a demolition contractor, and all the sort of funds raised to allow us to fully deconstruct that home. We then published a book with the catalogue of all the materials from the home, and we used that book launch around the country to call for creatives to submit designs with the materials from that home, and that led to those successful designs being then issued. The people that submitted those that were then issued the materials. We sent the materials all around the country and across the world, in fact, and then the successful objects were sent back. So we received around 400 objects made from the home that were later exhibited in Canterbury Museum in 2015.
So nice and slowly. You took it apart.
Yep.
Piece by piece.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And laid it all out somewhere.
Yeah, literally, Kate and the team of volunteers put it on trailer loads, took it to the storage unit, categorised it, photographed it, measured it, and created this taxonomy of what we think is the first time in the world that a whole house has been sort of classified in that way. Then we utilised that catalogue to call for designs, and then we had designs submitted from all over New Zealand and some from overseas, from people, from professional designers and makers through to hobbyists and school children, and you know, really fantastic for us people, legends of their time like Brian Flintoff, who's New Zealand's sort of one of the most remarkable carvers of Taonga Porou, and we had things like an amazing artist on the Isle of Tiree in Scotland. We sent her some broken window panes, and she sent back some beautiful slumped glass vessels. So some really wonderful creative responses that valued
so
that
people,
material.
People put in a bid and say, I want two taps and a cupboard door.
Yes. So they all had the same catalogue, and so it was quite a logistical process, making sure that different people didn't want the same stuff and all of that, and getting it out to people and then getting the finished objects back. But generally, Kate managed that process, and generally it seemed to work quite well. And
what was the most sought after bit?
I don't know. I mean, I think the timbers, the obvious things like the beautiful Rimu and things were pretty popular, but in the end it actually worked out. It was actually quite well spread, and we also did it in a couple of rounds, so it wasn't all at once. So we kind of had the first wave of designs, and then we had a second wave, and so it kind of was that were helpful to coordinate it in that way. Yeah, and then the variety of things that people made were just extraordinary.
So what sort of things did you get back?
So, like I mentioned, Brian's Taonga Porou, so he made some beautiful flutes and wind instruments, traditionally carved. We had Dallas Matoi, he carved these most beautiful boxes that were traditionally made to store the huia feathers. So they were just really three really beautiful ornamentally carved boxes. And we had Tim McGurk, who made a whole lot of stuff with his partner Emma Byrne. He made a double bass, which was called the double basin, which had a a basin as the sort of resonator for the instrument, and it was playable. We had David Truebridge make a magazine rack / coffee table. We had Nick Moon and Lynn Russell from Nelson make the largest object, which was this really beautiful studio building. And it was built in Nick's an artist in Nelson. It was built in Nick's garden and built for deconstruction so that it could be deconstructed to be brought down here to be reconstructed in the museum. So that was pretty amazing, and very beautifully finished. It was a really kind of she worked on it very laboriously, and kind of just the whole kind of finish was very sort of painstaking and beautiful. And there's some beautiful images on the website actually. Through to tiny little pieces of jewellery, beautiful jewellery made by people like Jeremy Leeming, and thinking of also the beautiful wooden type. We had some type, a whole synopsis of type carved out of the Rimu framing by a type fanatic, Russell Frost in London. He's a New Zealander, but he was over there. So he did that, and we've since been printing with that, so it's quite beautiful.
Oh, wow.
Did
you attempt to value the...
What, the outcome?
Yeah.
We're actually just in the middle of finalising an academic article on this, because we have. So what happened at the end of the exhibition was that the makers could decide what happened to the objects. So about half of them chose to put the objects forward into a charitable auction. So we literally have a monetary value associated with those objects as to what they sold for. Some of the makers also chose to gift their objects to the homeowners, which was really wonderful. And then the rest, I think most of the rest, either they went back to the makers, because the makers weren't paid anything, they did this out of their own good will, and so they could take the objects back, or they could gift them into the community if they had a specific community purpose in Christchurch. So we are doing sums around the value, the monetary value. We're also doing some sums around what was diverted and how much of an impact that would essentially have. So that's quite useful information to reflect on the rest of what happened here in Christchurch.
Did you get stuck with anything at the end?
Yeah. We really wanted to reuse the whole house, but the shame of it all was we actually ran out of time, and we would have been able to, you know, we could have kept pushing at it, but we had to commit to the exhibition, and we literally ran out of time. So we were left with a couple of toilet bowls. We still had we had things like corrugated iron, so they weren't. You know, we had things like buckets of nails, because the other quite interesting thing was that when the makers received the materials, their waste from their making processes we asked them to send that back. So we actually received buckets of nails from the timber and things like that. So things like that had a ready place in the scrap metal market, for example, if nothing else. So yeah, so in the end, I'm trying to think what was really hard to deal with. I mean, there were things like the borrowed timber, for example. The idea with that was that we weren't allowed to bring that into the Cannery Museum, funnily enough. so that stayed out in a paddock. And but you know, things like that can become wood chip, depending on its use. So yeah, we did really well, but I can't remember the number of items that we had left, but there was a chunk, but not too many given this. Scale of things.
Did the house have like visible history, layers of wallpaper and things?
Yeah, there was some cool things like that. There was things like, and actually some of the photographs, before we deconstructed the home, we had an amazing photographer, Guy Frederick, come and document the home. And there's things like, there's this beautiful cupboard in this sort of laundry bathroom area. You open the cupboard up, and inside was this kind of bright orange patterned wallpaper from the 70s. And, you know, yes, there's definite areas in the home where you could see this sort of patina of life in there. And yeah, and we spent time before we deconstructed it with the family, and we invited in some of the older families that had lived in the home before the current homeowners. So we really sort of traced as much of that history as we could and documented that, and we showed that in the exhibition with photographs and the like. So we really wanted to celebrate the life that home had held.
So is this story ongoing?
Well, it's sort of paused at the moment. Yeah, the next part we would really like to raise funds for is to document where all of these objects have ended up and in their current use. Because one of the key criteria that we had in the design brief was that the objects needed to have utility. So we would love to be able to follow the story of the objects and see the full kind of life of the house and its new use. But otherwise, we have looked at, with Enviro Schools, at creating an educational resource from it also, so hopefully we'll get to do that at some point. But that's probably it otherwise. But I guess it's legacy in the sense that we learnt a lot, and that's certainly spilling out into my work now in Kai Koura, for example. But it was certainly a journey we were quite pleased to sort of get to the end of the exhibition, just because it had, like, literally physically was an enormous process to manage.
And you worked with the museum to do the communication, the narrative around it?
Yes, and to show the work there. So there was so there's actually a lovely film online on the Whole House Reuse website that kind of depicts the whole story and gives you some sense of what was seen in the museum.
Would you do it again?
Well, it's funny you ask that. I've been asked that several times, and in some cases with a genuine wish to do it again. And I don't think I would. I think I would do parts of it again. I think there's ways that it could be done to make it easier. And I think there's ways that it could be done to make it have greater impact too. I think it's a wonderful way for a community to come together around something that they're feeling concerned about.
You talked about how building the community in terms of volunteers and are enterprises springing up out of this sort of work?
Yeah, I think to a degree. I mean, I think there's various things that happened here in Christchurch. We certainly saw, you know, a demolition, a boom in the demolition industry and the salvage industry. I don't know in terms of sort of creative entrepreneurs, I wouldn't say there's been that much. My sense about that in Christchurch is that there's been a lot of things that people have been dealing with. I think when you look at waste minimisation across New Zealand, though, we are seeing more and more of a, you know, a sort of more thoughtful, creative response to waste as a means of raising its value, so to divert it from landfill. And it's really lovely to see that, and I think, you know, you certainly see that in the work of the Community Recycling Network across the country and the awesome organisations like Extreme Zero Waste and Raglan and Wanaka Wastebusters and those organisations. They've been doing that for some time.
You talked before about a resourceful response. What's your take on resourceful?
I mean, that's become a really big focus for me. I think when I finished the Whole House Reuse project, when we sort of packed that up and taken a bit of a holiday, I realised that I didn't have the energy left to keep working with this focus of wastefulness. It was to the machine, the big waste-making machine, whatever it might be and whatever's contributing to that, is so vast and there's so much of it that for me, intellectually, it was becoming a struggle to see how to keep working with that positively. So I did a lot of thinking about, well, what's the other? What's the antithesis of wastefulness? And really out of that thought came this notion of resourcefulness, that if we were to look at our lives in that healthy state and that opposite state to wastefulness, it would be a resourceful way of life. It would be a way of living that allows us to be very much in touch with the resources around us, with the natural limits of those resources. And I think if we were living resourcefully, we would make the most of what we had around us in a way that meant that we came together as communities to share resources, and that we, I guess, took responsibility for what happens within the life of the resources we use, whether as individuals and as families and communities. So, yeah, so I think for me, more and more I'm focused in terms of developing that concept of resourcefulness, what it looks like, what are the realities of that. What do we do? How do we build that positive relationship with the material resources around us? And I think you can't help but reflect on that by reflecting on your inner resources as well. So it's not just, you can't separate out really our relationship with what's around us without considering how that makes us feel. Well, I can't anyway, I should say. So resourcefulness for me reflects both that positive state in terms of our real care and consideration of the earth and the resources that we utilise from it, but also how that makes us, how that impacts on us. So if we act resourcefully and say repair a piece of furniture or an appliance that breaks, then that changes the way we feel. We feel it builds our sense of the resources we have to cope. To feel confident we have what it takes to manage when we don't have much money but we have something break on us, or it builds our confidence that we have hands that do the things we need them to do, or that we know about materials and we know about wood or textiles, or, you know, and I think that sort of intimacy between us as humans and the resources that we live around constantly and interact with is something that it's sort of so present that I think sometimes we almost don't think about it, you know.
But do you feel as though you're fighting the machine?
I feel less like it now. So now the work that I'm doing currently with Rekindle is very much focused on those on the resourcefulness on depicting and bringing out experiences of that, offering people opportunities to feel resourceful, as well as still doing some work that is, you know, directly addressing wastefulness. So it's not that I've given up on that, it's just that the two for me need to show them both as parts of a continuum or a spectrum for me to feel that we're really focusing on what's positive and possible in all of this.
So what does a resourceful world look like?
Well, I think it's one where we are just fundamentally really aware of our relationship with what's around us, and therefore we don't discard of materials before they've had a full life. We also don't choose to use materials that are harmful to their origin or to the earth or to each other, or, you know, so there's that, all of that sort of knowledge about where things come from, where material resources come from, how we use them in relation to how that impacts the environment, and then I guess also how we share those resources, because how we share resources, how they flow within our communities, also relates to our access to resources. And in terms of poverty and the like, you know, I think there's a huge amount to be gained from living resourcefully in communities, in terms of improving our access to resources. Yeah.
Have we lost the ability to do that, though?
Oh, I think it's definitely compromised currently. I think our consumption and our sort of a lot of autonomy in our sort of daily lives around, I mean, not so much autonomy, but anonymity, I mean. So, like, each household tends to just do whatever they do with waste. You know, they're not obviously accountable to anyone else or anything. So there's not a lot of shared sort of problem solving around that. There's not a lot of shared responsibility around how we care for the resources that we have. And I think, you know, I know for efficiency's sake, it's good that we have, you know, great waste minimisation organisations helping streamline that. But the bottom line is that it takes away our sense of need to deal with these things. And in some ways, I think that's problematic.
Do you have any idea of how much of the, whether we want to see it as positive or negative, but how much of our individual contribution to the waste we actually have control of? How much of it is like upstream or downstream of us, mm-hmm. and we don't actually have much control over?
Oh, I think we do. I think nowadays we have significant opportunity to control it. I think, for example, this use of the second-hand market has been demonstrated to be a really considerable opportunity to divert material from landfill. So I guess effectively that choice of buying new or buying second-hand, that can really impact what ends up going to landfill. So, you know, I think it's not all about the designers or who's creating what we find on the supermarket shelves. Yes, that certainly contributes to things, and, you know, packaging and all of that is problematic, but we absolutely have the choices, many of the choices that we need around us in terms of avoidance of packaging and buying locally without packaging at all, and shopping secondhand, that kind of thing.
One of the things that we like to talk about is how a sustainable future is a better future, not a lesser future.
Mm.
And I think framing that in terms of this positive, this positive relationship. Mm. But to what extent are you and I, and a disappointingly small band of others, kidding ourselves?
Mm. See, I don't. I've sort of the occupational therapist in me looks at mental health statistics, for example. I can't help but look at that and think that is such a massive sign that we as a race are really, really struggling with our current way of doing things, and that our search for meaning, if you like, that in itself is really challenged by the current way that we do life. And so I think things are becoming so dire, both in terms of our mental health, but also in terms of the economic struggles that we're seeing around the world, struggles over natural resources and the like, that I can't help but think that when things change, as things change, that there will be some improvements there, because it's bringing us back to some of the fundamental realities, like the fact that we have limited resources, therefore we need to learn to care for what we do have around us. So I kind of, I guess I'm so biased that I can't see.
But as a species, you'd like to think that we're not stupid. So how come we've been so distracted by this party going on?
I just think it's so convenient. I think there's an allure of the sophistication of being able to purchase what you want, being able to have what you want, being able to wear what you want, when you want, eat whatever food you like, wherever in the world it's come from, whenever you like, whatever season it is, all of that stuff. But actually, we've splurged on that now. You know, people know that they can, you know, not everyone, of course, but people kind of understand those realities now. And I think the impact is such that it doesn't really make a difference. It doesn't really mean that we have everything we need, because in fact it's distracted us probably from what we really need.
Okay, some questions to end with. I don't think we've covered this one already, so let's do it now. What's your go-to definition of sustainability?
Oh, well, you see, I stay well away from the word.
Okay.
Just simply because I think it is a word that, for me, has probably been overused in some regards. I find it easier to talk about, I guess, some of the more specific concepts that make up a part of that, like resourcefulness.
That's a good plan. What's the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Success. Oh, that's hard. Well, I think probably the most meaningful thing that's happened in terms of my work was recently when supporting some of the planning that's happening up in Kaikoura post-quake. I was sitting in a room with a whole lot of others who had been heavily involved in the demolition process of the red zone here in Christchurch, residential red zone, and was to hear the will for change so that community can be more involved in deconstruction outcomes following these kinds of disasters. And that for me was incredibly heartening, and I felt like a definite sense that we have learned something from what happened here.
So we're writing a book of these interviews. We're calling it Tomorrow's Heroes, mm-hmm. looking back at the people who are doing good work.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you like to describe your superpower?
My superpower. Well, I think probably it's something to do with being a... my superpower. Oh, that's tricky. But something to do with maybe being able to see the inherent value of material resources and being able to transform them.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
I suppose I do nowadays. Yeah. I suppose I do. Just in the sense that I can't help but...
That sounds reluctant, though. Action or a reluctant label?
Probably a reluctant label, yeah. No, the action isn't reluctant. It's very... It's something I can't help, but I probably don't call myself that, no.
What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
What's yet to be done. I guess the opportunities that are there and the impact that I see that could have for people who would benefit from, like myself, who would benefit from being creative with resources that are undervalued.
What are you looking forward to in the next couple of years?
I'm looking forward to doing more green woodworking. We've just got a project that's being launched at the moment, and that's sort of pushing green woodworking out into the centre of Christchurch. We've set up a workshop in the middle of the city, so I'm looking forward to doing more and more of that myself, working with some beautiful old timbers from within the city.
Two more. If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur,
yeah,
tomorrow morning, what would you like?
Oh, I would just love to see... I would love to have a huge craft workshop facilities that will that had all of the wonderful tools, and everyone knew about them, and people were coming and sharing their skills, and I didn't have to make it happen.
Lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Nothing that comes to mind.
If someone gave you a big billboard that you could write on by a motorway, what would you put on it?
I would say something like, I guess I would ask people to consider that wastefulness is kind of like, being wasteful is in effect missed opportunities for resourcefulness. You know, if you think about where those opportunities for resourcefulness lie and seek them out, that probably will assist your will to get out of bed in the morning.
Thank you very much. You've been listening to Sustainable Lands Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. We broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelens.org. On sustainablelens.org, we are building up a searchable archive of conversations with people from many different fields who are applying their skills to a sustainable future. In our conversations, we're trying to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective. Through their sustainable lens, even if they don't call it that. Tonight's sustainable lens was that of Juliet Arnott, the founder of Rekindle. You can follow the links on sustainablelens.org to find us on Facebook to keep in touch, and you can listen to Sustainable Lens via iTunes as well as all the other poddy sorts of places. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.